Whole lot of trade on the program today. That's just the way the news broke, I guess. Also, another visit to Erie, Pennsylvania schools this time. And our series, The Big Promise, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 30th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin today with the American consumer economy circa mid-2017. We learned this morning from the good people at the Commerce Department that consumer spending was up last month at its fastest pace since December. Home prices are up as well, so said the benchmark S&P Case-Shiller Index. And along those home buying lines, the average American FICO score, a measure of creditworthiness, hit 700 in April, the highest average in more than a decade. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains how those scores got there and what they might mean for the consumer economy.
Part of the reason credit scores are improving is awareness. Mark O'Brien researches household finance at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says people now track their credit score as easily as they track their exercise on a Fitbit.
Is kind of metric of financial health that people are kind of paying attention to and maybe even adjusting their behavior to in order to kind of see that kind of increase month over month or quarter over quarter.
And the average American consumer has become more disciplined. Chris Christopher is with IHS Market.
Americans, since the Great Recession, have been cleaning up their balance sheet income statement. The younger generation saves more. They don't use plastic as much. So that all helps on that front.
During the Great Recession, a lot of Americans wound up so deep in debt that they declared bankruptcy. Those bad debts are starting to get wiped off people's credit reports as enough time has passed. With scores improving, lenders are going to be making a lot more offers for credit cards and loans. But Anna Maria Lusardi at George Washington University doesn't expect good scores will drive more bad borrowing.
The credit score is an indication already of behavior. Is an indication of what people are doing with their finances. So in this sense, I think we are seeing some improvement.
And yet household debt just topped what it was in 2008, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Also remember, credit scores don't capture the full picture of financial health, as many Americans simply haven't had access to credit. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
President Trump took to Twitter this morning. Trade was the topic, specifically the, quote, massive, end of quote, trade gap the United States has with Germany and how it was, again, quoting here, very bad. The U.S. does, in fact, import more from Germany than Germany imports from the United States. So far, so good, accuracy-wise. The bad thing? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
The U.S. each year buys about $65 billion more from Germany than Germany buys from us. Is that costing U.S. jobs?
I don't think the issue has anything to do with jobs.
Ilaria Moselli is senior economist for Europe at the Conference Board. German workers aren't low wage. They're not stealing jobs from us. But the imbalance with Germany does tell us some things about the U.S. and German economies. First, it tells us that German goods are really good.
Germany has done a lot of things to develop high-quality goods that are in demand.
Kent Hughes is public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. There's another reason we're buying a lot of goods from Germany.
Right now, these German goods and services are essentially on sale because the euro is relatively weak.
Steven Siegel is associate professor of finance at the University of Washington. Here's the problem with that.
It's not something Germany controls.
Germany can't control the euro any more than California can control the dollar. And right now, European monetary policy is having the effect of keeping the euro low, which, just as a big FYI, Siegel says, is exactly what the U.S. did with monetary policy after the recession.
Many countries in the world at that time were complaining.
So from a global perspective, it's a little rich for the U.S. to complain now. Kent Hughes with the Wilson Center says there are two takeaways from our imbalance with Germany. First, if Germany's doing so well, maybe we should be taking notes.
We can learn a lot from Germany in terms of institutional innovations that we could certainly adapt to our own economy.
And Germany actually could be taking notes from us, WashU's Siegel says. We have a trade deficit, but Germany has an investment deficit. It's investing more in us than we are in it. So what does our imbalance with Germany mean? Maybe more than anything, it's a teachable moment for our economies. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, tell you what, traders might as well have taken another day off. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The NAFTA renegotiation clock is ticking. President Trump has formally told Congress and Mexico and Canada that he wants to redo the nearly 25-year-old trade deal. Formal talks could begin as soon as mid-August. So we've called up one of the people who was at the table back then to get a little perspective. Carla Hills was the U.S. Trade Representative for President George H.W. Bush. Ambassador Hills, thanks for coming back on the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Last time we spoke, ma'am, you said NAFTA was a premier trade agreement, and this is a quote, for its time. What do you think of it now? It needs to be changed, no?
It needs to be upgraded. You know, we negotiated the terms of the NAFTA in the early 90s. You didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have a cell phone. We didn't talk about digital trade flows. I think we need to deal with those issues and make it even stronger.
Do you believe that things need to be added to the North American Free Trade Agreement or taken away, if that makes sense? Clearly digital and all of that stuff, yes, but what is in there that might need to not be there anymore?
I don't think of anything that needs to be subtracted. There needs to be a great deal added. When you look back at what the NAFTA actually did, it eliminated tariffs on all industrial products. We want to keep that. We have provisions to protect intellectual property, but intellectual property has expanded enormously since the early 1990s, but that doesn't mean we want to give away the rules that we have. We want to add to them.
This is going to be a three-way negotiation, right? It's the Canadians and the Mexicans and the Americans will all sit down at the table. What is your guess as to how these talks are going to go? Because when we had you on the program the first time, you related an extremely collegial environment, shall we say. What's your guess as to this time?
Well, it would be just a guess. I think that we were collegial way back 25 years ago, and my best hope is that they will continue to be collegial. After all, it's a win-win situation. North America has become one of the most competitive regions in the world, and we wouldn't be there by moving individually. We benefit from the supply chains that have linked our economies, and we want to keep that going.
Let me just ask you, as long as I have you on the phone, ma'am, I don't know if you follow the president on Twitter or if you've been paying attention to any of his remarks about Germany and the U.S.-German trade relationship. But if you're the German trade minister, with the president of the United States now taking aim at the German-American trading relationship, what are you thinking?
Well, I think it's much better to try to sit down and negotiate in a friendly fashion. My own view is that when you try to open markets, you benefit. You know, 80% of today's trade is conducted through global supply chains. Unfortunately, very often we hear that exports are good and imports are bad. But in this country, 60% of what we import are intermediate products that are used to make our exports more competitive. So if we are hostile or restrictive on our imports, we're not going to have the same amount or quality of exports. So let's be real and try to see what we can benefit from opening global markets.
Do you anticipate, just to get it back to NAFTA, you anticipate that this is going to get done and that we will, at the end of the day, still have a North American Free Trade Agreement?
I hope they move rapidly and get it done. You know, we negotiated the original agreement in 14 months. If they could move rapidly, it would make all the difference to businesses. And uncertainty means you stay your hand. And that affects the economy adversely. So, yes, they should move rapidly. And politics also recommends that they move rapidly. We don't know what's going to happen with the elections down in Mexico next year in July.
Carla Hills, the U.S. Trade Representative for President George H.W. Bush, did the NAFTA agreement for him. Ma'am, thank you very much for your time.
Great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
From the Center for Responsive Politics via the New York Times over the long weekend, this item: in the first quarter of this year, drug maker spent $78 million lobbying members of Congress. That's in 3 months. It's about a 14% jump over last year. Translates into 1,100 big pharma lobbyists, or put another way, more than two drug lobbyists for each member of Congress. So with that kind of competition in the office, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looked at separating the great lobbyists from the merely good.
The lobbyists that stand out are the ones who figure out how to make themselves indispensable. University of Kansas political science professor Burdette Loomis is reminded of someone he knew 40 years ago when he worked in Congress.
There was a guy around the office. I never knew exactly who he was. He was an older gentleman, had a cigar. Turns out he was a lobbyist.
Loomis says that grizzled veteran taught him there are lots of ways lobbyists can make themselves useful. Many have been around for years and know all sides of their issue better than the often young and inexperienced staffers in the office. They prep members for hearings, raise money, in some cases even write legislation. Meredith McGeehee, a lobbyist since 1987, says lots of lobbyists can do all of that. Only the special ones understand they're the supporting actor.
This notion of having to kind of go and be the one that is asking something from the powerful member of Congress. And you find a lot of people that struggle with that. The good lobbyists realize you have to take your ego out of it.
McGeehee says when an industry like drug makers blanket the halls with lobbyists, most realize they're rowing in the same direction. The game, she says, is to find some way to reach the lawmaker, and different lobbyists offer different ways in. Maybe it's common friends, or they come from the home district.
What the access does is ensure that that member of Congress hears your arguments so that it resonates with them.
The point, says McGeehee, is to make it seem like everybody the senator hears from is thinking the same thing. That, she says, is doing a good job. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The White House budget plan that dropped last week called for hundreds of millions of dollars to be spent fighting illegal immigration, beefed up border security, more law enforcement, extra detention centers as well. It also calls for saving billions of dollars by denying undocumented immigrants, who make up about 5% of the labor force, by the way, by denying them certain tax credits. Marketplace's Rima Crace explains how that might work.
Many poor and low-income families depend on the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Tax Credit to get by.
They are the programs that lift more people out of poverty every year that are working age than any other program.
Elaine Mugg is a senior research associate at the Tax Policy Center. Undocumented immigrants aren't eligible for the Earned Income Tax Credit. Under Trump's proposal, they would also be denied the Child Tax Credit. Families could lose up to $1,000 a kid, says Giovanni Perry, an economics professor at UC Davis.
There's not going to be a replacement income, right? Because while other family that falls below the poverty line have access to other support from the government, they won't.
Perry says the loss of the child credit could hurt communities too.
Where undocumented are a large part, this will affect the livelihood of the whole community and also of other people who rely on their consumption.
The Trump administration says it could save about $40 billion over a decade by denying the credit. David Beer is an immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute.
Ideally, no immigrants should be receiving cash welfare from U.S. taxpayers.
By immigrants, he means non-citizens. Beer says the U.S. should create a legal path for those who are undocumented, and in the meantime, let them work.
If we cut off all the welfare benefits to these people, there's really no argument at all for not letting them stay and contribute to our economy.
Instead, he says Trump's budget places top priority on deportation. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's like heaven inside. Like, I feel so good when I come here.
Not how most high schoolers think about school, I'd venture. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 50 points to start a short week, about 0.25%, finished at 21,029. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ down 7 points, about 0.1%, 6203. S&P 500 down 2 points. We'll call it flat, 24 and 12. Talked about some U.S. economic history with Germany. Sabri did, anyway. A couple of German companies that employ a lot of Americans. Bayer down 0.1%. Today, Siemens down 0.1% as well. BMW down about 0.3%. Coming out of big travel weekend, mostly road trips, but millions of people got on planes too. Avis Rent-A-Car up about 1.4%. Hertz down about 0.6%. United Airlines down 2.4% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury down to 2.20%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There was a story in the Financial Times this morning, more of a listicle, really, that made you stop and go, whoa. The FT put together a list of all the treaties and international agreements that the Brits are going to have to renegotiate when they leave the EU. 759 of them. 759 deals with 168 different countries. And to add insult to that injury, with Brexit negotiations with the EU set to begin in less than a month, the Brits are being told they are going to have to pay up to extricate themselves. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that one.
For weeks, Britain has been bombarded from Brussels with eye-popping and escalating estimates of the bill for leaving the EU. 50 billion euros, 60 billion, now more than 100 billion. UK Brexit Secretary David Davis told the BBC it was an EU negotiating ploy.
This negotiation will last up to 2 years, and this is the first part where we'll have this slight rough-and-tumble approach.
Davis, who has a reputation as a political bruiser, usually likes a bit of rough and tumble, but even he has warned he'll walk out of the talks if the EU negotiators do ask for 100 billion, and he'd have the backing of Prime Minister Theresa May.
That's why Theresa said that no deal is better than a bad deal.
He says even paying the remaining member states a 1 billion euro exit fee would be a lot. This could be tricky, says John Springford of the Centre for European Reform.
I can't imagine that the 27 will shift from their position.
Springford says the Brits are the second largest contributors to the EU budget. When they leave, there'll be a $13 billion a year hole. And so the rest of the EU, which is often divided, is as one on this issue. The Brits must cough up a very big exit fee.
That is the number one priority of pretty much every member state, because they don't want to end up filling in the payments that Britain would otherwise have made.
And he says the rest of the EU reckons that since the Brits want a free trade deal with the bloc after they've left, they'll settle the exit bill. But pro-Brexit lawmaker John Redwood is incensed that the Brits would be funding EU expenditure for up to 2 years after they've left.
If I decide to resign from my local cricket club, I don't then go and negotiate with them about how much longer I should pay the subscription. I just leave.
You do if you want to go back and use the clubhouse bar.
And then you would pay a commercial price for doing so, and that's perfectly reasonable.
But he says 100 billion euros isn't reasonable. And anyway, he says a free trade deal should be free. Some say what's needed here is a bean counter. And here is one.
I'm Ross Campbell at the Institute of Chartered Accountants in England and Wales.
The Institute of Accountants has just run its BDI over the EU books and come up with some figures that for Britain, in the best case scenario, are rather reassuring.
That bill could be as low as 5 billion sterling. That's equivalent to about 6.5 billion US dollars.
Campbell says the Institute not only added up Britain's share of EU liabilities, staff pensions, current farm subsidies and the like, but also deducted from the bill the UK's share of some of the EU's assets.
We have a number of investments made in European entities, such as the European Investment Bank, where we might rightly expect the money to be returned.
The accountants say they've tried to bring an objective view to a highly contentious topic, but...
At the end of the day, I think this will come down to a political deal being struck.
After all, Britain still needs to keep the EU reasonably sweet. It does want a free trade deal with its largest trading partner. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We're still in the relatively early days of the Trump administration's education policy. About all we know for sure is that the White House wants to cut about 13% of the Department of Education's budget. A lot of those cuts coming out of programs geared toward higher ed, everything from student loans to money for work study, which for those looking at getting into institutions of higher education could be an issue. And that gets us to one particular high school junior in Erie, Pennsylvania, and to our series, The Big Promise. As you know, we're spending the first year of the Trump presidency in Erie, looking at how campaign promises are playing out in places that voted for the president. Our education correspondent, Amy Scott, has been getting to know one refugee student as she navigates her first year in an American high school.
Hello, I'm Megha Ghimiri. I'm 17 years old, and I'm from Nepal.
Megha Ghimiri arrived in Erie last May with her parents and younger sister. The city they left behind was crowded, dusty, jammed with motorbikes and trucks. She told me when she got to Erie, the sky seemed wider.
Everything was so pretty, so beautiful. Like, it was like a dream. I cannot explain it.
Her family spent the summer getting settled and finding the right high school for Megha. Unlike many children in Nepal, she'd gone to school. In fact, her father was the principal.
My mom is a teacher, dad is a teacher, so I was in a good school with good guidance.
So good that she got into Northwest Pennsylvania Collegiate Academy, one of the top public high schools in the state. Megha is wrapping up her junior year, and she moves through the hallways of the palatial building like a natural.
It's like heaven inside. Like, I feel so good when I come here.
It wasn't that way at first.
I thought people were going to judge me because I'm a refugee, or they will try to bully me or something like this.
But she fit right in with all the other high-achieving teenagers. She's taking three AP courses, history, physics, and chemistry.
You guys want to talk about one of these, or you just want to take it from here?
We want to talk.
Okay.
Her pre-calculus teacher, Peter Wojciechowski, says when it comes to math concepts...
A lot of them, it seems that she's seen them before, so I have to give her some extra stuff to go a little bit beyond sometimes.
Math may be a universal language, but there is nothing universal about the cuisine of the high school cafeteria.
She got salad, like, for the first, like, half of the school year, and then just recently she was like, you know what, I'm done getting the little salads. I'm tired of the lettuce.
That's Megha's friend, Abby Matha. Today, Megha loads her plate with turkey, stuffing, and mashed potatoes.
She's just, like, exactly like me and my friend, but just, like, with a different voice and, like, looks a little bit... like, not just generic white girl like me.
Megha's even got that signature teenage nonchalance. On the way to their table, they barely notice a teacher who's being duct-taped to a pillar. You know, just another fundraiser for prom.
Sometimes I get shocked, like, why are they doing this? And sometimes I'm like, I feel happy sometimes, like, oh, they're doing this.
Prom's not in Megha's plans.
I'm just focused in my school and... my parents, my home, my sister, and my career. That's it.
In other words, college, college, college. She's got her eye on Stanford. She wants to study software engineering.
Ready? Two, three, and...
But she's not all business. After lunch, Megha heads to choir practice, where they're learning ABBA. At night, the family makes dinner together in their second-floor apartment. Megha helps her mom with the dal, while her father, Devi, chops ginger.
Everyone is divided with his own part. I just always make the curry ready.
Devi is originally from Bhutan. He fled an oppressive regime in the late 1980s and spent more than 25 years as a refugee in Nepal, where he met his wife Leela before they resettled here. They're not teaching anymore. She's a housekeeper at a senior center. He's working in a factory, making parts for farming equipment.
USA means you start again. So I'm now again starting right from the bottom.
With the hope that his daughter can start at the top. He says his dreams for Megha were nearly shattered when he found out how much college could cost. Megha is counting on getting a scholarship.
I have seen my parents struggling for life, for me, so I want to give them everything that they deserve.
She'll complete another American teenage rite of passage next month when she takes her SATs. In Erie, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, which comes to us today via the Google Trends Twitter feed, to wit, searches on the phrase how to spell, broken down by state, Some of them you get. Floridians apparently have a tough time with receipt, I before E, except after C, of course. Montanans stumble over surprise. I, too, have a hard time remembering that first R. The winners, though, are Wisconsinites who have to look up how to spell Wisconsin, which I would say is bananas, except that's the word New Mexicans can't spell. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 50 points today, 50 points, about a quarter of 1%. NASDAQ down 7, that's about a 10%. S&P 500 down 2 points. We'll call that, what's the word? Oh, yeah, flat. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow, okay? This is APM.